interdisciplinary research, which encompasses a broad area, literally environmental, energy, food, population, economic, and public policy studies. His methods ranging from quantifications and modeling of global biogeochemical cycles to long-range appraisals of energy and environmental options. With those different methodologies, Buslov has attacked a number of very, very big subjects. Substantively, he has written much on history of energy and energy technology. A couple texts to mention: Energy in World History, 1994, Creating the 20th Century, Technical Innovations of from 1867-1914 and Their Lasting Impact, and Transforming the 20th Century, Technical Innovations and Their Consequences. He's also, people may here may know, written for decades on problems of environmental degradation in China, going back to the 70s. Most recently he wrote Energy in China's Modernization, China's Environment, an Inquiry into the Limits of National Development, and China's Past, China's Future. Vaclav is also working on the question of the relationship between use of energy, globalization. At the forthcoming book, The Two Prime Movers of Globalization, coming out from MIT. He has written widely on prediction, he's forecasted much on the future of energy. A recent book, 2008, Global Catastrophes and Trends, The Next 50 Years, MIT Press, and I think forthcoming on that energy transitions. Finally, he has written directly on the question of oil. Oil, A Beginner's Guide, came out from One World Publishers, Oxford, in 2008, and I believe his book, Energy Myths and Realities, coming out, forthcoming, also deals with this question. So we're very pleased to have as our second presenter, Vaclav Smil.
Thank you. What I like best is when somebody just said, he will stand up and speak. I'll stand up. I like to stand up when I talk. The disadvantages and advantages coming second. I will have to be totally, I never plan what I will say. I'll say only when I stand up, then I will say, but coming after the weekend, I cannot help it. I have to react. Whatever I had in mind, I will largely discard, and I will react for about, 20 minutes to what David said. I think what he presented us with, what I would say, a mildly catastrophic view. There are even more catastrophic views out there, right? Namely, because I am one of the few people who say that the world will not end, the civilization will not end. I am in minority. People strangely now want to hear that we all will die in 20 years, 30 years. I don't know what with you people or with civilization in general, but people like to hear that message. It's the end. We all die. Civilization will end, right? It doesn't matter if it will end in 10 or 20 years. It will end soon, in this century. No, it won't. It will go on quite nicely. What we have to do, after this is a gathering of historians, right? Some Broderian non-pure perspective. Okay, but it's under the edges of the Department of History, right? And so there was this man, Fernand Braudel, and you have to take this long view. And when you take a Broderian view, well, I tell you some numbers according to Broderian view. People say 19th century, the century of coal, 20th century, the century of oil. All wrong. Most of the population is fundamentally innumerate in North America, particularly. Japanese kids, I just lived in Japan again. I came back five weeks ago. Japanese kids are still numerate. But in North America, people are utterly innumerate. You ask a high school student, what is 15% of 80? He wouldn't able to calculate it at all, really, right? I mean, just go and ask them, really, right? So, it's not so difficult to integrate the global production. We know the global numbers. So you integrate the global production for 20th century. We have damn good figures about coal and oil production in 20th century. Why? These are commercial fuels. We mine it, we sell it to somebody. We sell it for a price. So these statistics are excellent. For the 20th century, the number one fuel in 20th century was coal in terms of energy, your joules or your BTUs. We mined more coal than we extracted oil. 20th century was the century of coal. 19th century was the century of wood. In the United States, the coal consumption surpassed the wood consumption in 1884. Globally, the coal consumption surpassed wood consumption about 1895. You cannot pinpoint it, but roughly so on. So we went from a wooden era, which lasted for millennia until the very end of the 19th century, into coal. Right now, of course, we use more oil, but relatively we use less oil now than we were using 20 years ago. 20 years ago, oil was about 44%. Now oil is 36% of global energy consumption. We are actually using less oil relatively, although more oil absolutely, but we've been leveling the oil. Oil demand has pretty much leveled in the past 10 years. And if it wouldn't have been for China, it actually would have gone down, but I'll come into it in a sec. So oil is important, but it is not that important. The civilization which we have, we built on wood and coal. Right? Those of you are familiar with life in 1890s, all right, you know, the life expectancy was limited. Why? Well, because little kiddies were dying, right? Actually, if you look at the gains in life expectancy from 1900 to 2000, at age 45, right, down to about 4 or 5 years, right? The life expectancy total has increased massively because the childhood mortality was cut so dramatically, right? But life in 1890s or 1900s was a pretty civilized life. We have universities, we have electric lights, pretty good public transportation, we have streetcars, we have long-distance trains, which, by the way, were going faster than the trains in U.S. today. By 1905, you know, 1910, we have trains that were going 110 kilometers per hour. As far as the what we invented, Europe, Japan, they didn't sniff any oil except few ships and few rare uses until the 1950s. Europe and Japan were running on coal and hydroelectricity until 1950s. And you must admit that somehow that continent built a civilization, didn't it really, right? You know, Paris of 1880s, certainly this was not an uncivilized place. When Tokyo threw the first Olympics in 1964, well, you know, it wasn't an uncivilized place, and we just started to import oil in some quantity. So we can have what we call the high civilization without high consumption of oil. That is not a precondition of it. And just think of it, the Western civilization was not built on oil, it was built on wood, and it was built on coal. By the way, coal is still with us. Very, very large quantities of oil are burned all the time. Number one fuel in our civilization is not, number one energy form is not fuel, it's actually electricity. We prefer to convert fuel into electricity because electricity is much more flexible, much more convenient, you know, endless list of advantages. As far as electricity goes worldwide, number one source of it is coal, burning of coal. We rarely burn oil for electricity. In this continent, we don't do it at all. Back home in Canada, we don't do it at all. Who would burn oil for electricity now? It's too precious fuel because you can make all sorts of other stuff out of it. So basically, oil has shifted into this transportation market largely. As far as the petrochemicals, yes, it's an important petrochemical fuel, but it is not an important fertilizer fuel. Out of these 6.8 billion people, I did a whole book on this about a decade ago, about half of synthetic ammonia. You can do your calculations. Maybe like 40% of them hang on synthetic fertilizer. Without synthetic fertilizer, we would not have about 40% of the population. But all that ammonia is made from natural gas. Only about 5 or 7% is made from coal, really, right? From oil. So oil is a very unimportant feedstock for production of Haber-Bosch ammonia. Practically all is natural gas. Before I run away from it, there is plenty of natural gas out there. If you look at the prices of natural gas, you know what's happening to them in the U.S. They are plummeting. Right? They are plummeting because we have a great deal of new gas because of the horizontal drilling. I'll get into it in about 15 minutes, I hope. You know, oil is important, but let's not exaggerate the importance of oil. Okay? The importance of oil right now is only for people who have lots of transportation, well, a certain kind of transportation. Again, after living again in Japan, I always am pleased that, you know, you can live totally without oil. You look at typical Western city, and it either doesn't have a subway at all, like this place, or it has a subway which is like one line here and one like there. You take Tokyo, you take a little child, takes a crayon, and does this all over in different colors. And then the Tokyo subway lines, they go which and every way. You can go from one end of 30 million city to the other end of it in about 20 minutes for $1.50, right? Okay? And all of it is electricity. Most of it actually made from what? Either from nuclear or from imported liquefied natural gas from Indonesia. No oil involved in that, really, right? Plus, of course, you know, they have these trains. I mean, in Japanese, we call it, you know, new trunk line, Shinkansen, which go at a speed of 250 kilometers from city to city, following each other in peak intervals in what? In about 30 seconds in peak intervals, right? And they just go on what? On electricity. And again, that electricity is nuclear, because Japan is one of the big nuclear countries. France, of course, is the biggest one. And it's the imported natural gas. So, you know, you can have a lively, vibrant, inexpensive, tremendous, clean, beautiful transportation without any oil. And Japan does it every day to the tune of tens of millions of travelers every day. Of course, if it's LA, that's a different story. Then you have to have your SUV. Well, why don't I say something about America's self-inflicted...
What were you about to say about LA?
Yeah. Why don't I say right away about self-inflicted wounds and let's call it wounds. Let's not call it stupidity or idiocy, really. Look, you people have an energy consumption problem, but it's your problem. It's not a generic problem, really. Let's put it this way. This is a funny statement, too. If you people would be consuming oil at a French level, you'd be a big oil exporter. Because United States are still the world's third largest producer of oil. Somehow this gets somehow lost. People say, oh, U.S., it's importing 60% of its oil. Well, because you people are consuming oil as you are serving the dishes, right? You order a pasta dish in Italy. Well, pasta is a primo or secondo in Italy, right? We don't have a pasta as such, right? So if it's a primo, it will be just, you know, a little amount of pasta. If it's a secondo, it will be a bigger, but the diameter of the plate will be about this much, right? You order a pasta dish in last time, it was a couple of years ago in Israel and Berkeley, and there was a kind of a bowl on this side, and it was heaped like that. It was probably for a family of five. But that's the way you people use oil, really, right? Okay? In global terms, look, this is how it is. You people gobble up 360 gigajoules, okay? About 42 gigajoules is one ton of oil, right? So you gobble up almost 10 tons of oil, 8.5 tons of oil per year per capita, 360, okay? Remember that figure, right? Richest countries in Europe, France and Germany, gobble 170, okay? Less than half what you do. Now, this is a question. Less than half. You are more than twice. Are you people twice as smart? Do you people live twice as long? Do you people enjoy twice as high a standard of living? Give me Lyon compared to Flint, Michigan anytime. Let me tell you that, right? You know, let me tell you that, okay? So what is it you people got for 2.3 times as much energy compared to France or Germany? What is it you got for it? Screwed up environment. That's the only thing you get. Because the more energy you use, the only thing that you get out of it is a bigger environmental impact. Doesn't make you smarter. Doesn't make you safer. Has it made you safer? You have to buy, you have to beg Saudis, right? You know, to give it to you, right? So doesn't, didn't make you safer. Didn't make you smarter. You don't live longer. You don't have better schools. So you don't have to consume 360 gigajoules. Now imagine if the whole world would live like French, consuming 180, right? Be great difference. Or if the, I shouldn't say, if the whole world would aspire to 180 or 170. Mind you, the average for EU27 is 120. So 27 countries forming, you know, consume 120, which is one third of the American rate, right? Now, you people travel. So of course, Slovenia is not exactly like France, but is life unbearable in Slovenia, which is consuming 100, really. Go sometimes to Slovenia, right? It's the end of the Alps, Mediterranean. I mean, this is, I would like life in Slovenia anytime compared to Okeechobee or whatever, really, right? So, I mean, you know, there's no need for it. So imagine if the world would aspire, Chinese, Indians, people who consume less, or people who consume more would say aspire down and people who consume less will aspire up. If everyone would aspire to something like 100 gigajoules, right? instead of you giving the example to Chinese, because Chinese want to be like what? Not like Japanese at 160 gigajoules. Chinese want to be like Americans at 360. This is why they are selling 10,000 GM cars in China every afternoon now, right? GM is making billions of dollars every year on its China operation. Are you aware of it, right? GM, this restructuring, China operation is not a part of restructuring. GM China is extremely profitable. They are selling cars like hotcakes, right? Because Chinese are aspiring to 360 gigajoules. So, of course, if the whole world consumes 360, we are doomed in no time, really, right? I mean, this is a finite resource. There is a finite amount of oil, really. But how about if the world will just simply aspire to something like 100? By the way, the French example is deeper even so. French look at it, you know. French have this, you know, they may be dirigists and they may be, you know, these anarchs running the show, whatever. You know, but, you know, they do still think right. They look at it and they say, well, we'll have to buy that stuff in the future. And that's pretty stupid. So they crank up the nuclear industry. What do you think is the French nuclear industry? It's the Westinghouse reactor, which you people messed up because instead of building them in series, saying, ah, this is one 300 megawatt or 400 megawatt reactor, and I'll just make it cookie cutter. By the time I'm doing it 10 times or 50 times, I know exactly what you're going to be reliable, profitable, and cheap per unit costly. No, you people, because you don't have any nationwide electric utility, 77 different utilities, one wanted 350 megawatts, one wanted 420, one did it with some experience, one with no experience. As a result, eventually it took like 15 years to build, three times over cost or whatever. But French, based it on the good old American design, just took it, perfected the cookie cutter, and they produce 80% of the electricity from nuclear. Never had any accident, never had any problems, never had any explained to people, look folks, this is it. Either we do it ourselves with this remote little risk of radiation, or we beg the Arabs for it, right? And that's it, they did it themselves. So, you know, you can be nuclear, right? You can be reasonably semi-renewable here and there, I'll get into it in a while. But, you know, we are not hanging on oil for our dear life. We don't have to. We can do it differently, simply. Now, let's look at some of these things which are out there, like the famous King Hubbard, that it has to happen. I wanted to get this up so I could, but I don't have to do that. I just do it like that. Okay, this is the kindergarten statistics, right? You know, bell-shaped curve, Laplace Gaussian curve, beautiful, right? And most of the things operate accordingly. Well, except people are inventive. And we are inventive only when we have to be. We usually are not inventive just, you know, oh, it's a beautiful Sunday afternoon, let's be inventive, right? We are inventive only when we are pressed against that proverbial wall, right? And when we are, we do the things which unhinge that curve. Actually, when you look closely at the production of just about every place for which we have detailed statistics, there is no perfect Hubbard curve for anything in the world. For oil, for world oil, it's actually very unhinged. I can give you actually the perfect figures I calculated not too long ago. They say Hubbard was most successful for U.S., right? So Hubbard's peak estimate was based on the ultimate record of 200 billion barrels, right? But between 1859 and 2005, oil industry has produced only 192, right? And it's still the world's third largest producer, and nobody's suggesting it will, you know, close down with it, right? Hubbard's year trade for the year 2000, if you look at that curve, so we should have been down, well, on the downslope, and year 2000 was to be 1.2 billion barrels. Actually, in 2000, we had 2.8 billion barrels, which is 2.33 times higher. So, in just 30 years, he made a mistake of 230%. That's not a trivial mistake. Why this man is so celebrated as forecasting perfectly something when he's off by a factor of 2.5 almost in 30 years, it always eludes me really. But that was close. For the global thing, he wasn't even close enough, right? Because he predicted that we should have peaked long time ago and we should have been down. We've never reached the peak which he predicted. Why? Because we are needing actually less and less and less oil. This is one of the secrets which people somehow don't realize. What do you call the energy intensity of oil? How much oil you use per dollar of GDP or per yen of GDP or renminbi of GDP? That's been going steadily down, right? Would you guess how much you people, with your gross energy inefficiencies, how much less oil you are using per dollar of GDP compared to 1979, when the oil peaked last time, and the second oil was 50% less nearly per dollar of GDP, okay? And if you would do things right, you could use 50% more. I don't want to go there into this thing, what you could do right. This is the concern, this future thing. What you could write is just absolutely amazing. let me start with a flat statement. America could keep its standard of living, that is this America, not Canada and Mexico, but just the United States, could keep its standard of living by consuming less than half of energy which it consumes. Of course, because that's what French do, right? For example, look at a window. In this country of yours, it's almost unknown, something which is called double or triple pane window, okay? Because people assume, oh, it's a warm place. Why should warm place have double or triple windows? Well, for the same place, why in Winnipeg I have triple windows? I want to keep the warmth in winter. You want to keep the cools in summer. The same principle applies to it, right? So by properly insulating your buildings, you could cut down my wall, my window, which is a triple window filled with argon, right? It's actually as good as my wall. Right? That much R insulation it has. Not quite, but coming close to it. Because my wall is actually 2x6. Imagine if every house in U.S. would be 2x6 instead of 2x4. Wow, 50% more insulation, right? 2x6 instead of 2x4, right? 50% is involved. If you make a single window and triple window, that's like, factor or whatever. So, as I say, the window is as good as wall. So, if you would design your buildings properly, which is a difficult trick to do, because buildings, about 2-3% don't die every year, so turnover is just very slow, anyway, right? But how about your car? So, buildings, still, you could have the chance, right? You could start tomorrow, right? Everything is at least double window, right? Okay? And at a rate of 3% replacement, in 30 years, you get somewhere, right? But with cars, we have something like CAFE, right? Corporate Automobile Fuel Efficiency. And we started in 75 and acted 76. Between 76 and 85, in 9 years, we did what? We doubled it in this country from 13.5 to 27.5 miles per gallon. Okay? Then happened what? Oil prices collapsed after 81. 81, they peaked at $38 a barrel, which I tell you in a sec was pretty much the same like $147 last year and why it collapsed last year. But anyway, it was 38. And by 1986, it was $5 a barrel, below $10. So what do you do with CAFE? You said, there's no CAFE needed, right? Only $5, right? So since 1985, until the new things proclaimed by Obama recently, new CAFE over 30 miles per gallon, you kept it at 27, right? Since 1985, for 20 years. Imagine you people would have left the rate of CAFE 75 to 85 going on. You know where you would be today? Close to 50 miles per gallon, right? And you could be exporting that oil because most of the imported oil goes into your cars, really, right? It's totally self-inflicted, totally self-inflicted. Let me put it this way. Cars now, people keep them longer, they cost more. But you know what is the turnaround? It's about 9 years, right? Okay, 9 years, right? So in 9 years, the whole fleet changes. But you don't have a fleet of cars anymore in this continent because not only you dropped CAFE in 1985, but you decided in your collective or GM wisdom not to drive cars, that is half of you. Vans, SUVs, and pickups. No, it's pickups. This is what's called the other two-axle four-wheel vehicles in the GM parlance, right? So it's the pickup trucks. It's the vans and it's the SUVs. Hummers being a subspecies of SUVs, really, right? I love them. Military assault vehicle built for 16 men in combat. Choice car to go to pick up a whatever, a 1 quart of milk in 7-Eleven. Anyway, so there you have these three categories of things, which for all practical purposes are cars. They are used as cars, right? A single woman, right, is humps into this 3 tons car. Most of them weigh 2.5, 3, 3.5 tons, right? My Honda Civic weighs 900 kilograms. Actually, sorry, it's now 1,020 kilo because it comes standard with air conditioning. I don't know why I need air conditioning in Manitoba, but it comes standard. I have no choice to buy a non-air conditioned Honda, okay? I tell you a little more about Honda Civic. If everybody buys Honda Civic, the world would be sending all to the planet Mars, right? But you decided not to drive cars, and half of you are not driving cars, which are limited to CAFE, 27.5, right? So cars still must be 27.5. But these other non-cars used as cars, they are not required 27. As a result, they are what? 18, 17, 16, 19, 20. So the whole fleet of vehicles on the road, that is the cars and non-cars used as cars, has a mileage of 23 miles per gallon. That's what the North American fleet now has, 23 miles per gallon, pretty much the same in Canada, right? So imagine now if everybody, if we would have that CAFE going on non-stop, we would have been close to 50. Okay? But forget about the castle. Now there is this great opportunity. American companies are collapsing anyway. So why not just to let them collapse, go to Toyota and Honda executives, they'll be only happy, and just tell them, take all those factories in Flint and Georgia, and just make your average fleet vehicles there. Honda now is not making only the beautiful little Civic and a beautiful big Accord. Honda is also making SUVs, CRV, Pilot, whatever. But their whole fleet, the cars which they sell, has an average mileage 35, bigger than the mileage proclaimed by Obama for year 2000, whatever, really, right? So just give it to Honda, and they give you fleet of 35 tomorrow, literally, right? But better yet, tell to Honda, as I've been trying to tell them for many, many years, please go to your roots, okay? Don't try to be whatever. It's like, you know, like this Apple message, right? Apple company. Go to your roots. Don't make SUVs, right? Just make your Civics and Accords, right? And Civic, the Civic which I now drive, you don't need a hybrid. My Civic is close to 50, right? That's what it is, really, right? It's 48, right? So just turn it to Honda company, start making Civics. 48 miles per gallon versus 23 miles per gallon for the North American fleet, right? You more than double your performance, and in 9 years, right, it could be all exchange. In 9 years, have you driven Honda Civic recently? It's a car which seats 5 people. It's a car which has a 5 gold star rating for safety. It's as good as your Mercedes 300, okay? This is not, you know, this is the best designed car on this planet, period. Simple thinking, right? It's a very well designed car. Well, okay, it's a tough message to sell to this crowd when you are driving this mixture of Jaguars and Mercedes. But, hey, not for long, because, you know, you are now collectively in this country. The new figure came out yesterday, $68.5 trillion, right? This is the collective debt of this nation, $68.5 trillion, right? Okay? You added to it $4 trillion in past 6 months. This circus cannot continue for much longer. And you'll be only too glad to drive Honda Civic 10 years from now, right? Because don't listen to these green shoot things. I'm very optimistic on oil, but I'm not optimistic on green shoot American economy by the end of the year, right? This crisis wasn't made in 3 months. This will not go away in 3 months, right? But I think other speakers addressed this issue before. Right? As far as being catastrophic, there is this guy called Richard Duncan, and he is, you know, David is just he's extremely actually optimistic compared to Richard Duncan. Duncan has this thing which he calls Olduvai Gorge theory. And as you know, Olduvai Gorge was as well as the hominin caves with that club. So here's this picture, this beautiful Gaussian graph, right, going up and down. At the bottom, at the beginning of it, is this man is the club coming straight from Olduvai Gorge, right? Not a subtle message, the guy has a big club, right? Then he goes up, and at the peak is what? Well, like Armstrong in this, you know, moonwalking thing, like astronaut cover thing that was the peak of oil, right? And then it goes down, and by 2030, who is there? Man is the clock again by 2030, right? You know, all Dubai Gorge theory. Beautiful, right? You can access this beautiful picture on the net. And not going to happen. Not going to happen. We'll be, but 2030 will be more or less what we are today. Because energy systems change ever so slowly, because they are inertial as hell, because the infrastructure you put in place is worth trillions and trillions of dollars. There is no other infrastructure on this planet which is so costly, so complicated, so messy to replace as our energy infrastructure. Think about all these pipelines, think about all these mines, high voltage lines, liquefaction natural gas facilities, refineries, power plants, you know, you can't. So of course there is a former vice president who now says, repower America in 10 years. Well, this is like, you know, creating the biosphere in 10 years, right, you know. I mean, yes, we can repower America, but give me more like 80 or 100 years. I mean, these things cannot be achieved in a short period of time. These are inertial systems which last. And we, because we are such a bloody inventive species, when we get to that wall, we seek for improvement so we could keep in the pattern, because it's cheaper to keep the pattern than to choose a new pattern. So I am willing to take any bets up to about $15,000-$20,000 in this room from anybody that our energy system by 2020 will be very much like ours it is in terms of oil, in terms of natural gas, nuclear electricity, whatever. Why I say it even for oil? Because as I say, when we have to, we deliver. Actually, two best studied fields, or several best studied fields, come from this state, but we study them worldwide. You discover the field, right? And you drill around it, basically, always, you know, first discovery is nothing, just you don't know how much you have there. I should say first, reserves, the term reserves, has no physical meaning. It's an economic concept. Reserve is that part of resources which I can recover, yank out, extract from the earth with known technique for the known price. Hence, it's a constantly moving target, right? I get a new technique, I can yank more for lower price, right? So reserve is just moving, totally moving, right? So you discover a field, and you say, okay, I'll ramp up the production. So ramping up, it must, you know, resemble that beginning of the normal test. Must go up, can't go up like that. It shouldn't go like that. You wouldn't make your money. So goes up like that, right? And then you say, okay, I'll reach the peak, right? And then I will level at that for several years, and I'll go down, right? Then you drill more around that field after 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and you say, instead of having this test like that, actually this test now looks like that. I will ultimately recover, what we call the ultimate recovery, twice as much from the oil field, right? Then you eat another 50 years later, and you see, ooh, I recover that. We have oil fields. This is an old oil province, United States. We have oil fields from 1880s, 1890s. One famous oil field from 1890s now, which was forecast to run out in 1920s, then 1960s, then 1980s, you know. We'll be probably producing for another 50 years yet. The largest Chinese oil, Daqing, in Heilongjiang province, which was to run out any number of times. It's still producing. It's still producing about half of the Chinese oil. Why? Because when we say that we are, that these reserves are exhausted, again, this has no physical meaning. It's very movable. 50 years ago, we walk away from that oil field when about 20% of the oil from that oil was sucked out. By its own pressure, or we pump little water, a little gas, we got tired of it, walked away. 80% of oil in place, what we call OIP, was there. Then we started to increase the recovery rate to 25%, 30%, 33%. Now, my friends at BP, which is, you know, the second largest oil company in the world after Exxon, are confident that in all of their fields, they have a recovery of 40% within the next 10 years. Not all, but practically all. Right? By the way, you know, when you look at these pessimists, middle roaders, optimists, it's very interesting. Total, the big French company, they are catastrophes. We are running out of oil, there will be no oil, the end of the world, right? BP, the chief scientific advisor of BP, Peter Davies, says, what a joke, right? I mean, how many times we have these people telling you about 100 years? Actually, I documented in one of my books, we've heard this about 17 times already. There is no such thing. We'll discover more oil, and of course, we will run out, but it matters when we run out. It matters if you run out tomorrow, and matters when we run out 2000, not run out, but 2040, 2060, because it gives us more time to prepare, and that's a fundamental thing, because it's transition is a slow process. So when we will know that we'll be turning down severely by 2060, well, you know, we have whatever, you know, 40, 50 years to prepare for that, and then we can do more about gas, more about nuclear. On the other hand, if we would be certain that we are turning down next year, then it's something serious. Now, to address the other, because I will travel away too much in that direction, to address the other part of the issue, people always talk about supply, like supply is everything, but we can influence the outcome massively by demand. Suppose you are here in 1979, second oil crisis, energy crisis, oil prices zooming up to almost to $40, and the oil production actually peaked in 1979. So you could have been the peak oil theory saying, oh, this is a peak oil in 1979. We reached the surpass of the 79 production only in 1994. Okay? So it took us 15 years to get there. We may be in a similar situation today. I don't know. I never make any forecast because, you know, it's just, we don't know. I always like when scientists come to these things very humbly and saying, we don't know, we are too stupid, and we just never know what our inventiveness or stupidity, where it will take us 30 years from now. So I don't know, but we may have a depressed demand for another 15, 20 years. We've been there before, so, you know, it's not so unlikely. Or we may just simply find the light of the day and start doing smart things, really, right? And this is not so-called conserving energy, really. This is something very radical, as I say, you know, just coming, and look, you know, every building will have triple windows, right? You know, people always talk about creating jobs in new economy, right? And Obama and Estelle always come up with what? Wind turbines. Well, why not a stupid window? This would be made in U.S. This wouldn't be made in China, right? Because nobody would be bringing triple glass from China. Although knowing Walmart probably might, really, so one never knows, really, you know? But, you know, if you are looking for jobs for Americans, make lots of glass from local resources, make triple windows, fill them with iron, make a nice wooden case, and install it. Installing will be not done by Chinese, installing will be done by Americans, really, right, you know? And imagine changing every window to triple window and building every new building to a cold, which means, you know, styrofoam on the outside, district of your basement, right, 2x6, whatever. Every super insulated house, let's say my house consumes for the whole year what my neighbor's house consumes for 1 January. Okay? So it's not kind of, you know, energy conservation, a little bit of some whatever, you know, a fiberglass sticking in the corner around the chimney sort of, you know, when you have a draft. But radical rebuilding, radical rezoning, recoding, right? Imagine if you people would not have allowed exurbia. There were no exurbia in this country 40 years ago, right? There were just suburbia, right? But you said, oh, we let people to build a 50,000 square feet mansion, so like, whatever, 200 kilometers away from the city, 100 plus miles, commuting every day, right? You brought it on yourself, right? Japanese don't have exurbia, right? You know, French don't have exurbia, right? So, you know, by radically changing the way we deal with all these things, we could consume less than half of energy in this town which we are consuming, because I do consume less than half of energy which every career is consuming, and I'm not suffering at all. Although then, of course, I wasted on flying to UCLA and things like that, right? So that adds up to the bill. But me inside my house and me driving my car, right, I consume about 35% of energy of the average Canadian. But then I don't fly to gamble in Las Vegas as well. That's another thing, right? So don't underestimate the opportunities for not conservation, but for radical redesign of consumption of energy, more along the European and Japanese lines. And you may not like the message, but boy, when you owe close to $70 trillion, you better start liking it, really, because you will not be able to continue this pattern, really, right? Okay. As far as us being inventive, this is just, you know, every day I am stunned, and there is so much to follow now. I mean, even those of you who are technically totally kind of illiterate, you know that there is a diesel engine and there is a gasoline-fueled auto cycle engine. But they're actually both auto cycle, but sure, the diesel, big diesel actually, two strokes. Anyway, diesels and gasoline-fueled engine. One is inherently vastly more efficient than the other. The biggest diesels which we have now on big ships are 51% efficient, which is fantastic. Even small diesels are about 38, 40. Your average engine is about 22, 23, 25 if you are lucky, right? So we could increase the efficiency almost double it by having more diesels. What do you think Europeans are driving? Every second car is a diesel, right? Okay. What is the percentage of diesel in North America? Couple percent. Diesels are now as clean as anything because we have new rules in Europe now. Less than 10 ppm of CO2. We have hardly any sulfur in the fuel. It used to be dirty fuel, right? There is no particulate out of it. There is no sulfur. It's a very clean fuel. Now, Daimler, the people who brought us Mercedes-Benz cars, right? Daimler is now developing a new engine, which is two-in-one. Diesel auto, called diesel auto engine, right? Which at one speed will run this way, the other speed will run that way, and its efficiency will be massively improved. Imagine if everybody would drive Honda Civic, which would have a diesel auto engine eventually. Bingo, you have 65 miles per gallon, right? This could be within 10 years, right? So you see how the global demand for energy could be reduced so very massively. I mentioned horizontal drilling, the greatest improvement since we discovered that we could drill this way, right? Then by mistake, sometimes we started drilling way, but that was by mistake. They said, well, heck, you know, instead of by mistake, we should do it by design. So I have one pot, now I have one offshore drilling well, and from that I am drilling over several, many, many square kilometers. Now, we don't drill this way or that way. Now we can drill this way, third right corner, go this way, go up, go down, go up, go down. So we can follow the theme. Imagine you have the big oil fields have been all this stuff. We have run out of the giant oil fields in the well-known oil provinces, U.S., Canada. We will never discover giant oil fields, right? Like West Texas, like Cairn River, like Pembina. We will never discover those. There is plenty of small things. But small things are expensive to drill, because one small thing, you know, from the top, hit it, right? Another small thing, you have to drill here. Another small thing. But imagine you have lots of these small things, right? And you drill through them horizontally, let's say 2 kilometers. This is exactly how we are doing now, especially with natural gas, right? You have that natural gas, it's tightly held in a seam, and seam is, let's say, slightly undulating 1 kilometer below the ground, right? Before you have to hit it many, many times, right? And you recover only your pressure from the immediate vicinity. Now you drill through it, you can even fracture it a little bit so that gas goes. As a result, you know where gas is today? $4, right? This morning, at $3.99 this morning, right? What was it several years ago? You remember? 7 and something, really, right? This is because gas is getting out of our ears. Not quite, but almost, really. Because we discovered, not we discovered, we perfectly this crazy thing to drill along the seam, really, right? Unless all geologists of the world, minus probably 2 people out there, are wrong, there is more natural gas than crude oil on this planet. Okay? We haven't started to tap it. What is now developing is the liquefied natural gas industry. Until recently, they were showing this picture of this United States during the night. You can look at the picture of planet during the night, and you still see some extremely bright lights, huge chunks of bright light, southern Nigeria. Why? Because they are flaring the natural gas, right? Western Siberia, not that much, but they are flaring. So in many places they've been flaring, because if you couldn't build a pipeline from Western Siberia, did it, but from Nigeria, how do you build a pipeline to Europe or US? So lots of flaring of natural gas, right? Now finally came the time, because we improved the technology of liquefied natural gas tankers. They were always very expensive. Now they are pretty cheap. And you can now load, you can liquefy it anywhere, Indonesia, Nigeria, put it on that LNG ship and take it anywhere in the world. During past 3 years, liquefied natural gas has become a global fuel, like crude oil. You buy it somewhere, you transfer it somewhere else, right? The amount of liquefied natural gas which could be brought from Barents Sea in northern Russia, which could be brought from Sakhalin. By the way, Japan started delivering from Sakhalin this February to Tokyo. Tremendous amount of natural gas which could be liquefied and taken around the world and changed into the new oil of the future, because it will become a global market. It will not depend on the pipeline. This is happening as we speak. It's developing into a competitive world market. Before that, all LNG contracts were long-term bonds, you know, high price or whatever. So from the diesel auto engines to argon in windows, from liquefied natural gas tankers to simply living like French. Who the hell wouldn't want to live like French, right? If you give it that offer to anybody around the world, who wouldn't take it? That's 170 gigajoules per year per capita, 80% of energy from nuclear, beautiful public transportation, transatlantic everywhere, zooming up 300 kilometers between the cities. You know, it's a good life, really. So we can do a great deal to depress, not only slightly reduced, but to depress our energy consumption. And the French could do the same. French also has a great deal of, you know, inefficiency in their system. They could do better. Europe, those of you who are familiar with Europe is totally better service flying. 30 years ago, if you would say German businessmen from Berlin to Munich, of course you would take a train. Now everybody's flying, right? In past 2 years, European airlines added 500 new city pairs. You can fly now from Birmingham to Bologna. You can fly to Oporto in Portugal to Zurich, right? No more to hubs, you know, going from Paris or whatever. There are so many. So Europeans are flying more than ever because energy has been so cheap. 20 years ago, they were not flying. They were taking trains. And, you know, I don't think the quality of life was that lower in Europe, certainly 20 years ago. So Europe as well, as everybody, and Japanese, as efficient as they are, they too, those of you know Japan, I mean, over-packaging. If here you package it in one plastic, Japanese will package it in 6 plastics and beautiful cover on top, really, right? Also, and so on, right? All buildings are... everybody has tremendous opportunities. So if we can change the system to the tune of consuming half as much, so if we, say, agree with catastrophists and say, you know, given what we have, we will run out and whatever. Not run out, but we will turn the corner, right? Not the corner, but that's a figurative speech. We will go on the downslope of Gaussian curve by 2020, 2030. Well, we can postpone it by 20, 30 years. We can do it, right? There's still plenty of time. As far as when turning the corner, going the downslope, BP doesn't believe in it. The biggest international carbon, the Italian oil company, doesn't believe in it. Total believes in it. Exxon has a total neutral position on it.
What's the it?
That we will turn around and we will be going down, you know, that the peak will be reached on some kind of peak, okay? Many people believe in sort of plateau, kind of, you know, we go there and we stay at this, whatever, we are about 85 million barrels a day, so we get to 85 million, we have 85, we kind of, you know, be there at 80, 85, 87, whatever. Many people say we'll go 100 and above, many people say we will not reach 100. There's a tremendous uncertainty what will be. What I will say, referring to what I said before, we don't know, because reserve figures, David said, they are very unreliable. Reserve figures are extremely unreliable. And 90% of oil is in the hands of national oil companies, Saudi Aramco, Iranian national oil company, Nigerian company. These companies don't open their books to anybody. We really don't know how much oil Saudi has discovered in the past 20 years. Right? They just tell us exactly how much they produce, and we know it anyway because they export most of it, right? So all reserves, okay, all reserve figures are absolutely unreliable and questionable. Right? What's more important is that we don't know what is the total amount of oil in place, or ultimately the estimate of the ultimate recovery of oil. And there the difference is very substantial. There the difference points out to peak anywhere between 2020 and 2120, right? Most likely people now would say this if there is a consensus, but this consensus is weak because the basic data are so weak, maybe 2040 or something like that. So let me back up here and say this, that of course, you know, in physical terms, this is a finite resource like anything in the Earth's crust. It's exhaustible. It will be exhausted. But exhausted in what terms? Before this one, before Naimi, who's running the Aramco show, the Saudi Arabian oil minister used to be Ahmad Zaki al-Yamani. And he was sort of a semi-catastrophist in his early days, but when he quit and he started to think and write about these things and go in the lecture circuit, he developed this line which always brings a great applause whenever he uses it. It says, Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. Coal Age didn't end because we ran out of coal. England is underlain by coal. England has, you know, billions of tons of coal. And England is not mine. England last year mined 10 million tons. It's importing more than 50 million tons from South Africa and Australia because simply cheap, right? So we will not run out of oil because we run out of oil, right? Because there's no oil. There will be plenty of oil. Remember, even today, the best field, which we say is exhausted, has 60 to 65% oil sitting in place. We will leave lots of that oil behind because we'll do something else. Something will be cheaper and smarter. What it will be, I can't tell you. As a part-time historian of technical advances, it's like sitting here in 1900 and telling you what we will do in 2009, right? What would I tell you in 1909 that we were in 2009, right? You know? I mean, in 1909, you know what was the second largest producer of oil in the world? It was Romania, right? And first one was Russia, right? And, you know, I mean, you know, things change over 100 years, and you'll never know. Well, 1909, Fort Model T was just introduced 2008, but there were basically no cars. And by that time, Edison still believed in 1909 that it's the electric car which we'll have today, right? That is this Ford newfangled. Ford actually wanted to employ him, right? It's a crazy story. So, you know, 100 years to say what it will be, so I have no idea what it will be, what combination of radical redesign of consumption, some renewables, some nuclear. Why did we abandon nuclear? It works very well, you know. Belgium 70%, France 80%, lots of European countries 50%. It works, it's safe, and we are not about to run out of nuclear fuel. Of course, we cannot. There is no single resource which can step in. Because right now, think of the breakdown, right? 35% worldwide is natural gas. 29% is coal. 36% is oil, right? And the rest of it is primary electricity, primary nuclear and primary hydroelectricity, right? And now we are adding renewables like, you know, wind, and then we'll get solar, whatever. So we have to attack in a very broad line. We have to have this and this and this and that. No single thing will be able to step in and save us, right? But we are not beyond saving. And on this list of these catastrophic things, I think accidental war or a deliberate war, for that matter, would be much higher on my list of dangers than running out of any resource. Because if you run out of one, we'll substitute. There are very few things where we cannot substitute. And one thing where we cannot substitute, which would worry me, is phosphorus. Because you cannot grow crops without three macronutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Okay? Nitrogen we can crank out. If not from oil, we are cranking it from natural gas. If not from natural gas, we can crank it out of coal. We can always, you know, get it out by, you know, just taking electricity, I mean, using electricity to hydrolyze water, get hydrogen that way, and there's plenty of nitrogen in the air. So we could, you know, make ammonia more expensive, but we could make it. But we have no way. You know, there's a limited amount of phosphates of high quality. There's lots of phosphate, but they are contaminated in the ocean. Whatever. So if I would worry about running out of something, it's out of phosphate, because you cannot do anything without the macronutrients. Right? But running out of oil and, you know, ending the Western civilization and having the club man from Uruguay walking around in 2020, that's the last of my worries. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right.